Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will bring us our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Brazilian police claim the United States is the largest supplier of guns that end up in the hands of Brazil's armed criminals and drug dealers. Brazilian federal police released a report on guns in December 2017. The Reuters news agency published a story on the findings earlier this month. The report noted that Brazilian police have seized more than 10,000 weapons since 2014. It said most were seized in and around the city of Rio de Janeiro. About 1,500 of the guns came from the United States. Reuters noted that the guns often traveled through another country before arriving in Brazil. The news agency said that the U.S. weapons were mainly assault rifles and high-powered handguns. It noted that guns already in Brazil or arriving from other countries were often smaller handguns. The U.S. continues to be the largest indirect source of illegal handguns and assault rifles as a result of unrestricted sales in stores and fairs in American cities, the report said. Violence fueled by illegal guns has risen in Brazil since 2015. An economic recession from 2015 to 2017 led to spending cuts for many police forces around the country. The federal government sent troops to Rio de Janeiro and other areas last year to control violence related to the drug trade. The report calls for international groups, such as the United Nations and the Mercosur Trade Group, to offer more support to stop illegal arms trafficking. Mercosur has four member countries: Brazil, Argentina, Paraguay, and Uruguay. The report named eight foreign stores. They are suspected of selling the most high-powered guns that ended up in Brazil. Five of the eight are in Florida, in the southeastern United States. The largest seller, however, was a store in Paraguay. Guns from the United States generally enter Brazil through direct shipments of assembled weapons, shipments of gun parts, or indirect shipments through a third country. Brazilian citizens can legally own guns, but only if they meet a series of requirements. Even then, they can only buy small-powered weapons. In the United States, laws governing gun purchases differ from one state to the next. But it can be a relatively simple process to buy a gun or get one that was legally sold to another person. The Brazilian police report noted an instance in which 22 assault rifles arrived in Brazil in a shipment of furniture. Most of those guns ended up in São Paulo and Rio de Janeiro. In another incident, 60 assault rifles from Miami, Florida, were discovered inside swimming pool heaters in a shipment at a Rio airport. The report noted that the entry of high-powered weapons into Brazil is linked to groups known to rob banks, bank ATMs, and armored vehicles.
Sumaya Beruti is a 38-year-old English teacher who lives in the city of Homs, Syria. Each week, she passes destroyed buildings and huge sand barriers as she goes to visit her parents in a neighborhood once held by rebels. Beruti works in Damascus, but spends 2 days with her parents in Homs each week. They live alone in an apartment that has recently been repaired, but the area is heavily damaged and very few people are left. Rebels and many civilians withdrew from the central part of the city in May 2014. Beruti's brother, Rabi, was killed in the rebel-held province of Idlib in 2015. She said, "That was the biggest loss. Neither the house, nor the work, or any other thing was as painful as losing Rabi." The family home is in the center of the city, formerly held by rebels. Cars cannot drive in the neighborhood because the streets remain severely damaged from shelling. Beruti said her family has lived in 8 different places since the beginning of the Syrian conflict 7 years ago. The family fled Homs when rebels first took control of the city. They moved to Damascus, but returned 1 year later. Since then, they have rented several apartments. After they moved into their most recent apartment, the United Nations helped them with repairs. The family installed new windows and doors and filled holes in the walls. 3 years ago, Beruti's younger brother was almost 18. He wanted to move to Turkey to find a job and avoid required military service. The family spoke to relatives in a rebel-held village in Idlib, who promised to help him move to Turkey. Beruti and her mother, Tamador Shilar, said the relatives informed extremists about Rabi. The militants belong to a group, Jund al-Aqsa, which has been linked to the Islamic State. The relatives told the militants that Rabi was a government supporter. Within a few days, the young man was placed on trial by members of the group. They sentenced him to death for supporting the government. Weeks later, the family received Rabi's identity cards and belongings through a taxi driver who operates between rebel-held Idlib province and Homs. A letter said he was killed because he did not join the holy war against the government, Beruti said. Beruti's father said they are lucky to have a home. He noted the family now gets 12 hours of electricity every day and 2 hours of water service. He can walk for 30 minutes to reach a market to buy food. No Western countries have said they are willing to help finance Syria's reconstruction. The government is rebuilding an old marketplace. It also is repairing places of worship, such as some of the city's old churches and the famous Khalid bin al-Walid Mosque. However, most neighborhoods are still in ruins. Homs governor, Talal Barazi, told the Associated Press about 30% of the city's population before the war have returned or remain. I'm Mario Ritter.
Machines equipped with artificial intelligence, or AI, have performed better than human beings in a high-level test of reading comprehension. Two natural language processing tools received higher test scores than humans in recent exams. One of the tools is a product of the American software maker Microsoft. The other was created by the Chinese online seller Alibaba Group. Alibaba reported its success earlier this month. The company said that a deep learning model developed by its Institute of Data Science of Technologies was the first to beat the human score in the reading comprehension test. The test is called the Stanford Question Answering Dataset. It was developed by researchers at Stanford University in California. The test has over 100,000 questions and answers. They are based on information found in over 500 stories from the Wikipedia website. The answers to all the questions come from the reading material. The AI-powered machines were tested on whether they could provide exact answers to the questions after processing large amounts of information. Alibaba said its deep neural network model received an exact match score of 82.44 on the Stanford test. Microsoft reported that a team at Microsoft Research Asia had a score of 82.65. It said the human score on the same questions and answers was 82.304. Microsoft and Alibaba were tied for first place on a list of the top performers on the Stanford test. Lua Si is the chief scientist for Alibaba's Institute of Data Science of Technologies. Lua said it was a great honor for his group to be part of such a technological milestone. He noted that researchers have made great progress in the area of machine reading and comprehension over the past year. Alibaba said it has already used its reading comprehension model in different parts of its business. For example, the company is using machines to answer many incoming telephone calls from customers. The company says in the future, the technology could enable machines to guide visitors through museums or provide advice to medical patients. Microsoft said its success in the reading test marks an important development for artificial intelligence and its reading capabilities. The company said in a blog post that it believes the technology will lead to easier, more natural communication between people and machines in the future. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Last time, we talked about Martin Van Buren. He was sworn in as the 8th President of the United States in 1837. Not long after he took office, the United States suffered an economic depression. It lasted 6 years. The depression was the major problem during Van Buren's presidency, but not the only problem. In foreign affairs, one of the chief problems Van Buren faced was a dispute with Britain about Canada. Canadian rebels had tried twice to end British rule over Canada. They failed both times. Rebel leaders fled to safety in the United States. There, they found it easy to get men and supplies to help them continue their struggle. The rebels built a base on a Canadian island in the Niagara River, which formed part of the border between the two countries. The rebels used an American boat to carry supplies from the American side to their base. In December 1837, Canadian soldiers crossed the Niagara River and seized the boat. One American was killed in the fight. For a while, Canadian forces and the rebels exchanged attacks. A number of American citizens assisted the rebels. President Van Buren was troubled. He declared that the wish to help others become independent was a natural feeling among Americans. But he said no American had a right to invade a friendly country. He warned that citizens who fought against the Canadian government and were captured could expect no help from the United States. Another problem between the United States and Canada at that time concerned the border along the American state of Maine. That part of the border had been in dispute ever since 1783. That was when Britain finally recognized the independence of the United States. Years later, the King of the Netherlands agreed to decide the dispute. The king said it was impossible to decide the border from the words of the peace treaty between Britain and the United States. So he proposed what he believed was a fair settlement instead. The United States would get about twice as much of the disputed area as Canada. Britain accepted the proposal, but the United States did not. The United States refused because the state of Maine would not accept it. In 1838, Britain withdrew its acceptance of the proposal. Canadians entered the disputed area. The governor of Maine sent state militia forces to the area. The soldiers drove out the Canadians and built forts. Canada, too, began to prepare for war. President Van Buren sent General Winfield Scott to Maine. Scott was able to get the governor to withdraw his forces from the disputed area. He also received guarantees that Canadian forces would not enter the area. The danger of war passed. Americans in the border area, however, were angry with President Van Buren. They believed he was weak because he did not want war. The president was losing support, not only in the Northeast. People all over the country were suffering because of the Depression. Most people believed Van Buren was responsible for their troubles because he continued the hard money policies of former President Andrew Jackson. Historian Joel Silby is an expert on Martin Van Buren. He says most historians do not think Van Buren was a strong president. However, Joel Silby says Van Buren left an important legacy.
When when it comes to the political system, he was a brilliant innovator.
Van Buren organized his political party, the group that came to be known as the Democrats. In the late 18th and early 19th centuries, people who supported independent farmers and states' rights over a central government generally followed Thomas Jefferson. They called themselves Democratic Republicans or Jeffersonian Republicans. Jeffersonian Republicans opposed the Federalist Party. They believed the Federalists wanted a strong national government, a powerful banking system, and a small elite social class. But after Thomas Jefferson died, the Jeffersonian Republicans broke into factions. They divided their support among several candidates during presidential elections, and as a result, often lost. Joel Silby says one of the things Van Buren had learned was that above all else, when you have an ideology you want to fight for, you need unity. Van Buren organized political clubs and political leaders in New York that all supported Jefferson's ideas. He brought them together to talk about their political beliefs and choose a single candidate for their party. In the 1828 election, Van Buren had expanded this organization. His insistence on political unity had helped elect Andrew Jackson. And his system of meetings eventually became the national conventions that political parties use today to officially nominate their candidates. Van Buren also helped create the modern political campaign. In the 1820s, he noticed many state constitutions were lifting some of their voting restrictions. As a result, more people were allowed to vote. Historian Joel Silby says Van Buren wanted to bring these new voters into his political party.
He borrowed from a couple of minor parties the notion of popular campaigns where you persuaded people through campaign rallies, speeches by prominent people, and on election day, getting them out to vote by your organization's agents.
Joel Silby explains that these techniques to persuade and mobilize voters were new to national politics. Now they are some of the major features of political campaigns. Martin Van Buren's political tactics earned him a few nicknames. Some called him the Little Magician, because he knew how to win elections. Others called him the Sly Fox of Kinderhook. Kinderhook is the town in New York where Van Buren grew up. The term Sly Fox is not entirely positive. Joel Silby says the nickname suggests that many people did not feel they could trust him.
Van Buren is the first person to be seen as that, a manipulator, unfairly said he would do anything to win an election, and he had no real principles.
However, Joel Silby says Van Buren did what he thought was necessary to preserve Jefferson's ideals. In the election of 1840, Van Buren ran for a second term as president. This time, his opponents used Van Buren's political skills against him. Joel Silby says the Whigs used popular speeches and rallies to portray Van Buren as a failed president.
During his reelection campaign in 1840, crowds of Whigs would chant, "Matty Van is a used-up man," because he no longer had any power or effect on things.
The Whigs also nominated a military hero they believed the people would love. He was General William Henry Harrison. Harrison had led an attack on Indians in the Indiana Territory in 1811. Many people believed that the battle at a place called Tippecanoe was a great victory for Harrison. But Van Buren's party, the Democrats, spoke of the 67-year-old Harrison as an old lady. They called him Granny Harrison. One Democratic newspaper said the old man did not really want to be president. It said Harrison would be happier with a $2,000 a year pension, a barrel of hard apple cider to drink, and a log cabin to live in. Hard apple cider was a popular drink among working men, and at that time, a great many farmers still lived in log cabins, houses made of rough logs. The Whigs were the party of bankers and businessmen. They saw a chance to use the Democrats' statement to their own gain. It gave them a way to present themselves as the party of the working man and the small farmer. "The statement is right," they cried. "The Whig Party is the party of hard cider and log cabins." The Whigs put up log cabins everywhere and offered free hard cider to everyone. They organized huge outdoor meetings for thousands with food and drink for all. They held parades and marched with flags, bands, and pictures of William Henry Harrison. Many campaign songs were written. These songs told of Harrison's bravery against the Indians. They told how he loved the hard and simple life of the common man, even though he was really a Virginia aristocrat. The Democrats made their own claims. They said Harrison could not read or write. They said he would not pay people the money he owed them. And they charged that Harrison even sold white men into slavery. Senator Henry Clay said the campaign was a struggle between log cabins and palaces, between hard cider and champagne. The state of Maine held elections in September of 1840. Voters in Maine elected a Whig, Edward Kent, as governor. They gave the state's electoral votes to Harrison, celebrated as the hero of Tippecanoe, and to his vice presidential candidate, John Tyler. The election results produced a new song for the Whigs, "And Have You Heard the News from Maine and What Old Maine Can Do?" She went hell-bent for Governor Kent, and Tippecanoe and Tyler, too.
"Then let them talk about hard cider, 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 and log cabins, too. It will only help to speed the ball for Tippecanoe and Tyler, too. For Tippecanoe and Tyler, too. And with them will beat little Van, 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 Van. Oh, he's a used-up man. And with them will beat little Van."
One by one, the other states voted. The election was close in the popular vote, but Harrison received 234 electoral votes compared to only 60 for Van Buren. And so William Henry Harrison became the 9th president of the United States. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.